Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Super excited to talk to my partners in crime today about our topic. Wade McFall, assistant special agent in charge, now retired, one of the managers on our SIU investigative team. And Matt Kachansky, the retired special agent in charge out of our headquarters at the OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director. And I looked at my license this morning and I still am Eric Rubenstein. Unless someone is changing my identity, I'm still Eric Rubenstein. I am the Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse here at Advise. So what we want to talk about is there's been an uptick. If you start reading some of the press releases out there, there have been a recent uptick on cases that involved what are known as nominee owners, beneficial owners, shell companies, phantom companies, whatever you want to call it, where providers come in and investments, whatever it may be, they buy up a distressed business and then create a new business out of it, or just for the purposes of nefarious content, they're moving money through and laundering and things of that sort. And, you know, typically when you look at these shell companies, it's the true owner or the beneficial owner is trying to mask or hide their involvement in the business, their ownership in the business. And there are a couple of things. When a provider becomes a Medicare enrolled provider, they are required in signing their Medicare application to indicate whether or not there's greater than 5% owners. Oftentimes you see that on LLC paperwork in the state that you have to disclose if you're greater than the 5% owner. And what happens is, because a lot of these individuals have prior convictions or have some other issue in their background, exclusion or something like that, which would preclude them from being able to get into the program, you see these instances where this happens. It's also pretty commonplace in instances where somebody is trying to provide a cloak to show that a bunch of independent businesses are not really independent. They're all interconnected through some central servicing. In the pharmacy space, I worked on a case right before I retired involving a guy who owned about 20 pharmacies that were quote unquote independent. And what he was doing was he was buying up distressed pharmacies that were in financial trouble, buying them up and then putting the LLCs in the name of various employees that he had working for him. What was interesting is that when we interviewed a lot of the employees, they really had no idea. Some of them were told that it was going to be a business venture for them. I remember speaking to one lady in particular, very, very low level customer service person, you know, $18, $15 an hour answering phones, and was approached by the owner of this corporate kind of entity and was offered an opportunity to have a no cost to her investment in a new business venture. And she was like, sure, I would love to do that. And what they wound up doing was handing her over the signature page for the registration of an LLC, which she signed, but had no idea what she was signing. And it was pretty clear from the interviews that she really had no idea what was going on. And the whole purpose of this was this individual was deeply involved in mail order shipments of lidocaine and diclofenac, which is Voltaren, which is now no longer a prescription. It's over the counter. And he was trying to create an air of independence by having 20 or so pharmacies that appeared to be individually owned and operated, but really were just part of his conglomerate. And he would play this game of whack-a-mole. When the pharmacy got caught by a PBM for something and was terminated, they would just move the patients from one pharmacy to another and play this. And so the use of these nominee owners becomes very prevalent when you're talking about trying to mask true ownership in the healthcare, traditional medical space. Sometimes they call it doc in the box, where the doctor is just kind of relegated to doing what everybody around him is telling him because he's not the true owner of it. So these are very interesting cases. You see them now with they call MSOs, management service organizations. There were a number of cases recently out in Texas involving rural hospitals and payments that were going through what was known as this MSO organization to try to facilitate getting kickback payments to doctors in return for the referral of certain lab tests to these rural hospitals. So pretty prevalent, and it's just a matter of things just kind of recycling into different pieces. And so with that, Wade, you know, one of the things that always becomes the investigative challenge is knowing that you've got a limitation from the beginning. One of the pieces that you're never going to be able to see fully from an SIU perspective is going to be the flow of money and the transfer of money and where that money goes. On the SIU side, you're going to see basically the claims coming in and you're going to see the money going out to some bank account, but you don't get to see any of that. So there are some investigative challenges, but there are some things out there that you can do that are outside of the traditional kind of financial piece, right? There's social media and some of the internal things that you can do as far as data analytics and just kind of having that, again, the relationships.
Yeah, that's true. And we were seeing a lot of around tax time, we would get a lot of new kind of cases generated because we were having all these physicians who are getting 1099s or W-2s saying, this is showing that I have an extra, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, a lot of times $200,000-$300,000 at a location that they were unfamiliar with. They're saying, this is not me. I drove by. I don't have an office there. You know, what's this all about? So they would call CMS, get some information, and they'd figure out kind of what was going on. Then it would come to the IG's office and we'd start looking at it. And a lot of times it was the new location was a, you know, it was a either like a mailbox, et cetera, a mail drop of some type. A lot of times we were finding locations that were like the fourth or fifth floor of a sweatshop in downtown LA with the elevator not working. And this was a place that was billing for power wheelchairs. So it's like, how are the people, you know, getting there? But as you mentioned, it's the whole whack-a-mole pay and chase situation where you get somebody, whether it's a clinic administrator, whatever, does a change of ownership. They get this new location that the physician doesn't know about. They bill high volumes in a very short period of time. And then they pick up and move on. So there's that investigative lag time. By the time the OIG starts looking at it and starts doing site visits and surveillance and whatnot, they've already been in that location for a month or two, billed several hundred thousand dollars, and then moved on to a new location that we don't know about yet at this point. Then what comes into play is the, you know, if they're doing this behind the physician's back, the checks go, or in the old days it was a check, now it's an EFT. But the money goes to in the name of the physician, and now the clinic administrators or whoever is doing these change of ownerships and kind of driving the bus for this, they now have to either change these checks into cash or they have to have an EFT situation where they can access the funds. And that's pretty much easier than the whole check situation because a lot of these physicians give all their information to the clinic administrator. So they have passwords, they have everything. The other thing is a lot of times you'd have some involvement. The physicians would be involved early on because they were doing kind of some shady billing for services not rendered. So they were kind of in bed with the clinic administrators, the true owners of the clinic, but then they would be kind of duped and they had other, you know, they became identity theft victims. Ultimately, they didn't know what was going on in clinic number two or three or four or whatever. But a lot of times these, you know, it was hard to make the connection between, you know, we would first find that the new location. It's like, how did this come about? There was, you know, there wasn't another person's name on it. It wasn't a typical, a lot of times it wasn't like a nominee owner. It was in the name of the physician and the physician, nothing about it. So we're trying to follow that up with, you know, public information on the new location. A lot of times you could find information on LinkedIn or Facebook, things like that. But that was less so with the kind of the organized crime. We saw a lot of Armenian, Russian organized crime in Los Angeles, and they were pretty careful about not to post a lot of, you know, pictures with names of their compadres and things like that. You could still find them, but that was one of the avenues we would try and find to kind of connect those dots and do like an I2 graphic where you show the connections between the different entities and things like that.
You know, and we talk a lot about that there are visual tools out there. We talk a lot about in the EFT fraud cases and what we've spoken about over the past couple of weeks and the fact that there are all of these tools and some things that you have out there. And those visualizations can never be understated. And certainly from the SIU perspective, when you have access to certain tools. You have subscription services that are out there that cull together inordinate amounts of publicly available information, right? The Accurance, the Clear, you know, back in the day, TLO and some of these other services where you can, you know, you can get some information. I just recently found that Moody's, the investment group, they have a tool for potential shell company investigations where they can put together a bunch of back-end financial information, things that come out of like Dun & Bradstreet, 10K filings, which are the filings that go to the SEC for publicly traded companies, things of that sort. You can kind of, you know, glean a bunch of information from that. But, you know, the important piece, which you could never, you never can discount, is the inordinate positive effects of using social media as a trolling tool, for lack of a better term, yeah. Is setting up a shell Facebook account. See what I did there? I used the term shell. Using creating a shell Facebook account or a shell for LinkedIn. And the one example I love to give is when I was working on this particular pharmacy case, we went onto the website for the parent company because we knew who the parent company was, and they were kind enough to have put up on their webpage kind of a gallery of events that they did. So, you know, they would have a Christmas party or a holiday event or an anniversary event for the company, and there would be a picture of 30 people. And they were kind enough to actually put under the photograph, first row, left to right, you know, Eric Rubenstein, Director of Customer Service, Wade McFall, Director of Warehouse Operations. And then all you had to do is go back and look at all the LLC paperwork from all the different pharmacies and go, well, that didn't help you. And then you go up on the LinkedIn and all these people's true jobs were there because they were trying to obviously put themselves out in LinkedIn. So you can never discount the availability of public information when you're doing these kinds of things. And Matt, you know, so that gets to the next piece, was as an investigator, our brains work in a certain way. And you know, this is why we're not mathematicians or scientists. Our brains work in certain ways. And one of those ways is thirst for a resolution. And, you know, as the great Kenny Rogers would say, you got to know when to hold them, you got to know when to fold them. And as an investigator, and really in leadership and in management, you've got to be able to say to somebody, you're doing a great job, but you've come to your natural stopping point. You know, it's my hair came to a natural stopping point at some point, and I had to readily recognize that I could no longer have the haircut that I had previously. You have to know when it's time to say, I have done all that I can. Where can I move this to so it's not in my hand? It really is very tough to try to get someone. People don't ever want to let go of things, right? And you have to know when to stop.
Right. And especially with cases like these, which can be, you know, literally spider webs that keep expanding and expanding to, you know, areas beyond, you know, even the visualization tools can't catch it. You know, in the UPIC, we had a situation very similar to what was going on in LA, where it was these management, a management company was running dozens of individual independent provider, you know, clinics and shops. And the doctors were basically paid a salary, had no connection to the business. And they would, and this management company would assign them dozens of PTANs. So if we start looking at their billings in this one place, they would just move them to another place. And it was whack-a-mole with the providers. And because at the UPIC, we were provider-centric, we couldn't really look at the management company. They weren't a provider. So we were going after these individual providers, one after another, trying to catch them, stop the bleeding, and it would just keep getting broader and broader. I came into the UPIC at that point, and I said, stop. Let's gather what we have. Let's connect the dots here. So we started following the beneficiaries. So all these places, made all the connections, put together one referral to the OIG saying, here are all of the connected parts, and here's where they all come to, which was a billing company or management company that was headquartered in Uzbekistan. you know, and they had a website as well, and they had all the pictures of their people on there in New York. And but the fact was, they were all Photoshopped. These people were actually located in Uzbekistan. So all the beneficiaries' information was being sent to Eastern Europe. You know, and I'm sure they have good HIPAA controls there. But it just became so complex that we couldn't stop it. And so we sent it to the IG, and they took whatever actions they could. But then we started working internally, because we started seeing the patterns that you saw. What we saw were common addresses that they were using. If one business moved, the management company owned the building, they would bring in another provider into that address. So we worked with the, you know, the Medicare MAC, and put up, you know, let's look when these addresses come up as for a new provider. Let's stop the payments right away. Let's put them on prepaid. Let's suspend them right away, because this is a suspect address, a red address. And so we worked with their enrollment and got that in place so we could stop the bleeding right away. So that was, you know, but we basically couldn't take these cases to the resolution because they were too big for us. So we would take care of them individually as they popped up and let the IG and the Justice Department handle the global one. But it was probably a 2-year effort on our part to put those things together.
Right. Yeah. And that's the challenge. The challenge is there more that can be done before you have to send it out? And at what point do you kind of draw that line? And that, you know, that becomes part of that, you know, part of that challenge. And so I want to, you know, as we kind of wrap this one up a little, Matt, the other piece of this is the importance of that cross, I mean, I hate to use like project management speak of cross-functionalization, and I just think that those are terms that as investigators, it's like, it's, you know, do we work with other people? Call it whatever you want to call it. You know, if you're someone who likes to speak corporate speak, then, you know, have at it. Just make sure that when you're speaking corporate speak, everybody else that you're speaking to understands corporate speak. You know, it's a little bit like when we're using vernacular within our industry, we think that everybody understands what we're saying. But the important take home is that, for example, in the pharmacy case I had, the PBM in this particular case, there was one PBM that started it. They were working very, very closely with the health plans, the sponsors, as they sometimes will call them, because the PBMs in the pharmacy space do not have relationships with providers. In the SIU medical space, there is an indirect relationship with the pharmacies because it's part of that network and all of that. But there really needed to be very close communication between the SIU on the medical side and the SIU on the PBM side, because there were some tools that I learned about that the PBMs had that the medical SIU teams did not know about. And once those pieces were put together and the medical SIU teams learned about what the PBM's tools were, it made the investigations move much faster, because the medical people didn't even know to ask the questions. And I'm on with, for example, the PBM people, the PBM SIU, and they're telling me about some information that they had. And I said, well, how did you know that? And they said, oh, we have this tool that does XYZ. And I'm not going to obviously disclose that. And they said, we have this tool that does XYZ. And I was like, oh my God, that's phenomenal. Why doesn't your SIU, medical SIU team know that? And once the medical SIU team learned that, it really helped with being able to show referral patterns from doctors, because it opened up the door to understanding more about where these shell companies existed. And so, Matt, kind of at the as the final piece of this is that cross collaboration, cross communication. And I think, you know, we beat this horse dead almost every week about how SIUs are not anymore about just the F word, the fraud. It's about fraud, waste, abuse. It's about compliance. It's payment integrity, and it's program integrity. And what I'll always say is program integrity is the whole payer. It's all about making sure the program continues on. And the payment integrity piece is that fraud, waste, abuse, compliance component. If you don't collaborate, communicate, and share your investigative techniques, you're spinning your wheels.
Absolutely. And these types of cases are the perfect example of that. I mean, with the one with mine in New York, it was we worked with the MACs, we worked with enrollment, we worked with CMS, we worked with their suspension team and their to show them what we had found and what the impact was to the program and how the, you know, the millions that were going out the door as we were trying to shut them down one by one. We needed cooperation amongst them to stop the entities as a whole, to stop the enrollment folks from giving out dozens of PTANs to individual providers because for whatever reason, they had no business reason for it, to alert them to the addresses so they could stop the payment, to work with CMS to allow us to do the suspensions right away. That's the only way to be effective in these types of things. You know, referrals are great to the OIG, but that's 2 years down the line. In the meantime, there's hundreds of millions of dollars going out the door.
Right. And in the commercial space, it really shouldn't be treated any differently. You know, we talk in the government space about payment suspensions relative to credible allegations of fraud. And obviously, there's a lot of subjectivity in what is actually a credible allegation of fraud. But there are in-network contracts, commercial contracts. You know, when you get into the PBM space, you start talking about any willing provider and issues involving the terms and conditions and all of that. But if you've got something that shows that you've got a shell company there, you've got to shut that down. You got to stop that bleeding, because what we see is these companies come in, it's a pump and dump, right? They call them, you know, my pharmacy case, the guy that owned all of these pharmacies, he would call them burner pharmacies, where he would just bill, and send out thousands of tubes of lidocaine until he got caught. And then when he got caught, he did transition fills, which allowed him to get a chunk of money at one time, because you get to have an additional fill or multiple fills, and then you go about your day. And the last piece before we kind of send this off is, you know, Wade alluded to it. He talked about the chow, the change of ownership. And one of the benefits of a change of ownership is that if you are in network with a, for example, in the pharmacy space, if you are already in network with those pharmacies, in a change of ownership, those contracts go with you. They are a transferable asset. Most of the time that these distressed pharmacies are being sold, they're not being sold because they're doing well and they have a robust patient base. They're being sold for their contracts. It's really that's the value, that's the asset. And those change of ownership trackings can really help you. You can see those, you can go and get an account for Pecos, and you can go through and you can look at those things, seeing, you know, public filings and the like. So there's a lot could be done. I think that, you know, while similarly to what we talked about a couple weeks ago involving the EFT fraud cases, there's a lot that can be done outside of the financial piece that kind of all bring a lot of this to light. And a lot of these investigations don't require substantial subpoena issuances and things of that sort. So, you know, they're out there. You just need to have the data analytics to be able to show, hey, why are these patients moving or these members moving from this place to this place? And wait, 6 months later, they're at this place. Why is that happening? And that's really one of your first red flags. And we could have, obviously, we have these conversations all the time about the data and, you know, where you're going to have your data lie. This is yet another example. So good stuff as always, guys. These cases are super important. There's a lot of money involved. We see all the time, you know, $100 million in fraud from companies where it's really a shell. The $2 billion catheter case is a great example where they came in and they just bought these distressed or small companies, pumped them up, a bunch of, you know, LLCs that were created for the purposes of masking, you know, what was going on. So they're out there. You just have to stay diligent and work these cases. And again, no one to hold them, no one to fold them, no one to move on, no one to collaborate, no one to make that referral and move on to the next case. Don't hang on to a case for years because you're not necessarily going to get any further than you were 6 months beforehand. You know, going and checking LinkedIn every day isn't necessarily going to further your case, right? So stay vigilant. Again, we appreciate everybody for sending in their comments, questions, and suggestions. We really do appreciate that. We look forward to continuing the engagement. We've got a whole bunch of LinkedIn Lives planned through this summer. You'll be seeing some more information up on our website and our LinkedIn on that. So please stay tuned to that. And again, every week you can get the OIG Roundtable delivered to your inbox from the newsletter. Just go to our website, advisehealth.com, and you can get that newsletter right into your inbox. And until next week, we'll see you guys on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you.
Thank you all.